This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, a video showing the fatal shooting of a young black man by a Michigan police officer leads to a public outcry in the U.S. Russia imposes tit-for-tat sanctions on nearly 400 members of the U.S. Congress as well as dozens of Canadian senators. Plus, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank protest against Israel's deadly crackdown in the city of Jenin and elsewhere. Hello and welcome, everybody. 10 days ago, a white police officer fatally shot a black man, Patrick Loya, in the state of Michigan. Now police have released footage of the moment of his death. Authorities say that Patrick Loya was killed after the officer's gun discharged during a lengthy struggle, but his family argue that he was shot execution style. According to several other released footage, initially the police stopped Loya, claiming he was driving a car with a mismatched plate. Loya started running and later got into a fight with the officer. The victim tried to get hold of the officer's taser, after which the officer tackled him to the ground and shot him in the head a few seconds later. Michigan officials say an investigation is underway. The incident has triggered some protests and rallies in the U.S. The protesters called for justice for the 26-year-old and the black community as well. The victim's attorney says the police shooting has been unnecessary and excessive. The officer who shot Loya is currently under paid leave, but his police powers have been suspended. This is the latest example of U.S. police brutality against minorities in recent years. Moving on, the New York Police Department says the suspect in the Brooklyn subway shooting on Tuesday has been arrested. The African-American suspect, identified as 62-year-old Frank James, was arrested after a day-long manhunt. He's now facing a federal charge of terrorist attack. On Tuesday, the gunman put on a gas mask, and detonated two smoke bombs in the 36th subway station in Brooklyn before firing 33 shots into the crowd. 10 people were wounded, but none sustained life-threatening injuries. The suspect is said to have posted videos of himself ranting against racism in the U.S. and calling for violence on his YouTube channel. And as the conflict in Ukraine enters its 50th day, the war theater is shifting mainly to the east and south of the country. Here's the latest developments. Ukrainian forces claim they've damaged a Russian warship in the Black Sea with missile strikes. A Ukrainian official said a flagship of the Russian Black Sea fleet carrying more than 500 crew members has been targeted. Russia has confirmed that its missile cruise ship has been seriously damaged in a blast. Moscow says the ship's crew has been evacuated and the cause of the fire that caused the explosion is under investigation. The Russian Defense Ministry confirmed that its troops have now full control of the port in the besieged city of Mariupol. Moscow has also threatened to strike Ukraine's command centers in the capital Kiev if attacks on Russia continue. Moscow has accused Kiev's forces of attacking a territory in southern Russia. Commenting on the situation on the ground, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said a humanitarian ceasefire in Ukraine, quote, doesn't seem possible. Russia ups the ante in the war of sanctions, with the West imposing retaliatory bans on nearly 400 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. Russia's foreign ministry says the sanctions against U.S. lawmakers include a ban on entry into Russia. The ministry says more sanctions will follow in retaliation for Washington's punitive measures over the Ukraine war. Russia also introduced sanctions against nearly 90 Canadian senators. Moscow says more bans will follow due to Ottawa's, quote, short-sighted policies. New measures come in response to sanctions imposed by the U.S. and Canada on members of the Russian State Duma, the lower house of parliament. The West has slapped many rounds of sanctions on Moscow, including the exclusion of several banks from the SWIFT payment system. Western countries have also expelled dozens of Russian diplomats on alleged spying charges. The United States has approved an additional $800 million package of military assistance to Ukraine amid the ongoing war with Russia. U.S. President Joe Biden made the announcement following a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. The new aid package includes heavier military equipment such as helicopters, armored personnel, carriers, and weapons. The latest package brings Washington's total military assistance to Kiev to over $2.5 billion. The package was approved by a mechanism that allows the president to transfer articles and services from U.S. stocks without congressional approval in response to an emergency. This is while Russia has warned NATO against providing military assistance to Ukraine. Moscow says it considers vehicles carrying weapons to Ukraine legitimate military targets. Britain's two most senior politicians, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, have both been served with 50 penalty notices by London's Metropolitan Police after breaching COVID lockdown restrictions. Both have so far resisted calls to step down, but for how long? Amina Taylor reports.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the Cabinet Room shortly after 2 p.m. lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, but about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those who lost loved ones during COVID. And the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank turn out against the deadly Israeli military operations that have intensified in recent weeks, especially in the city of Jenin. The protesters marched on an Israeli checkpoint north of Ramallah. They voiced their support for Palestinians in Jenin and called for an immediate halt to Israeli operations there.
Today, this march comes in response to the call of our people and brothers in Jenin and Nablus and a rejection of the policies of field execution, killing and ethnic cleansing by Israel.
We went out today to say that Palestinian blood is indivisible. Palestinian blood is one, from Rafah to Jenin, even Ramallah to Jerusalem. Palestinian blood is one. We cannot leave the Zionist occupation to single out our people in Jenin.
Elsewhere, Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says occupation, terrorism, and foreign invasion are the main threats to security of women in the West Asia region. Zahra Ershadi mentioned the current situation of Palestinian women and girls as a clear example of this issue. Ershadi noted that sexual violence against women is a crime often used as a war tactic and a terrorist and by terrorist groups, Iran's deputy UN envoy said. Putting an end to all forms of armed conflict is the best way to prevent such violent crimes. She made the remarks while addressing a UN Security Council meeting on women, peace, and security. Iran's foreign minister, Iraq's foreign minister Fuad Hossein has visited Tehran for talks on issues of mutual interest. This as Iraq has been brokering talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which could lead to the resumption of diplomatic ties between the two countries. Yusuf Jalali reports.
It's the second time in 7 months that Iraqi foreign minister Fuad Hossein has visited Tehran. The Iraqi diplomat's trip came upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The two-hour talks were held behind closed doors, but from what the joint presser suggests, regional security topped the discussions.
We appreciate the role played by the Republic of Iraq in maintaining regional understanding. We also talked about Syria and expressed our opposition to the fact that parts of Syria are still occupied by military bases of other countries without seeking permission from Syria's central government. We also talked about Afghanistan. Iran and Iraq welcome an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan that encompasses all ethnic groups.
Iraq has been mediating talks between Tehran and Riyadh over ways to resume diplomatic ties between the two regional rivals. After more than 5 years of icy relations, Iran and the Arab Kingdom stand on opposition sides in the Saudi war on Yemen, which has been ongoing since 2014, with Iran calling for a ceasefire. The Iraqi foreign minister says a fifth round of talks due in mid-March was suspended, calling on both sides to quickly resume the discussions.
Iraq and Iran's security is tied to the security of the region, so Iraq will continue to play its part as a mediator for dialogues between Iran and Saudi Arabia to hopefully bring the two countries back to diplomatic relations.
The Iranian foreign minister, for his part, thanked Baghdad's constructive role in brokering the Saudi-Iranian talks, saying Tehran is ready to come back to the negotiating table.
We thank efforts made by the Honorable Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Iraq to resume Saudi-Iranian talks. We welcome this initiative. When it comes to the Saudi war in Yemen, we believe that a sustainable ceasefire, the removal of the humanitarian blockade, and a Yemeni-Yemeni discussion without any foreign intervention could help the Yemeni people decide their fate.
Iraq and Iran are close political and security partners. This partnership was best manifested during the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq, when Tehran helped dislodge the terror group there. But when it comes to trade ties, both sides agree that they need to do more, putting the current bilateral trade volume between the two countries at roughly $14 billion. The two sides now agree to take steps to at least double this figure.
Tehran and Baghdad's ties are basically defined by security cooperation. But let's not forget that Iraq was among the countries that maintained their economic cooperation with Tehran in the peak of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Now, this last visit is seen as another step forward in the two sides' trade and security cooperation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have held a rally in front of Iran's embassy in Kabul to show solidarity with the neighboring Iran amid an ongoing conspiracy targeting friendship between the two nations. Here's a look.
Iran and Afghanistan are brothers. We remain united. No to conspiracy against two neighbors. Afghans here chant as they're rallying to show solidarity with Iran.
We have gathered here on behalf of the Afghan nation to voice solidarity and unity with the great people of Iran. We are demonstrating the truth today, which is brotherhood and neighborhood between the two Islamic nations. We also urge the officials of two countries not to let anyone take advantage of recent developments.
I had been a refugee in Iran and got an education there. Then I returned to Afghanistan to serve my people. Iran's hosting of refugees was generous. I demand Iran continue their assistance to our poor nation. Afghans always needed Iran, and so do today.
Attendees also stressed the need for people's awakening at the time of enemies' scheme. They say fake media and enemies' propaganda must not mislead public opinion. The rally comes 2 days after a number of people who are described in media reports as extremist elements attacked the Iranian diplomatic mission in Afghanistan. Afghans here say they don't let enemies plus harm their friendship with the Iranian people. They praise Iran for years of close cooperation with Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For many people in Syria, the whole month of Ramadan marks a difficult time of the year as they are suffering from poverty and food shortage. As our correspondent Muhammad Ali reports, many Syrians are struggling this year to put food on the table.
It's Ramadan, the holy month in which people fast from dawn to dusk. Syrian markets and souks are widely popular here in Damascus, like Bzouriye and Hamidiye, especially at this time of the year. Thousands of people shop for their daily basic needs despite the deteriorating economic situation and high prices due to war and unjust economic sanctions.
It's a war that always affects the state's economic capabilities and production. It led to a drop in the local currency and thus the high prices as well as economic sanctions that deprived us from many commodities.
NGOs in Syria work to support the society. Saad is one of them, and they have been cooking every year during Ramadan to provide breakfast to people in need. Thousands of meals are prepared by volunteers on a daily basis to be distributed in various cities. After sunset, Damascene nights are unique. Shows and performances are organized representing the country's culture and signaling Syrians' determination to restore normal life. In Ramadan, people rush to do good. Syrians in this month help each other overcome the repercussions of war by helping the needy and working together to rebuild their country and its economy towards a safe and prosperous Syria. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. God says in Ayah 16 of Surah Qaf, and we nearer to him than his jugular vein. It means Allah is present always and everywhere. He hears our voice. He is aware of our innermost secrets. He knows our intentions. But we are unable to sense his presence, our sins and indecent acts, and our wicked intentions and bad morals cause us to forget God. These pollutions make a thick curtain over our heart and deprive us from seeing realities. God is omnipresent. He is with us in every step and with every breath. It is He who helps us sleep, and it is He who gives us new life to wake up. He never neglects us, but we often neglect Him. God has manifested His omnipresence in the Quran. Whenever we recite the Quran with attention, we understand that we are in God's presence. We have heard that in the blessed month of Ramadan, God's throne is nearer. In fact, God's throne is always near to us, as He is nearer to us than our jugular vein. However, Ramadan helps us come a little out of negligence and understand God's presence better. Nevertheless, had it not been for God's favor and mercy, we could never get such an understanding. Ramadan is the spring of the Quran, and if we cling to the Quran, it will help blossoms of spirituality and godly merits flourish in us. Thus, we will be able to feel God's presence better. In this way, our whole life will get the color of God, and it will affect our social relations too. Once man understands that God is ceaselessly supervising his deeds, he will not wrong others, and he will be benevolent toward all fellow men. Now, dear listeners, let us speak about some of the conditions of correct fasting. Fasting of a mad person or a drunk and unconscious one is not correct. A traveler cannot fast if he travels a certain distance before noon prayer. Fasting of a sick man is not correct if it harms his health. Here, we should pay attention to a few points. One cannot break his fast because of weakness, hunger, or thirst. But if he becomes so weak that he cannot tolerate and fasting harms his health, he should break his fast. Fasting is among the worships which an individual performs eagerly and without fear or compulsion. In view of this, the relation of the beloved and lover can be seen in fasting. Fasting is done to satisfy the Creator. Thus, during the hours of fasting, all pleasures are inferior and have no value in comparison with pleasing the Lord. The individual is negligent about foods and drinks. He pays little attention to carnal desires and pleasures of flesh. He is plunged in the love of real beloved. This has occurred especially in the lives of the friends of God. The commander of the faithful, the leader of the pious, and the prophet's first infallible successor, Imam Ali, blessings of God upon him, says, "My God, what makes me restless is only your remoteness. Even if I endure your punishment, how will I endure your remoteness?" Imam Ali, peace upon him, used to help others benefit from the spirituality of Ramadan. For instance, when he was going to the mosque for congregational prayer, he would inform everyone by calling loudly, "O people, prayer, prayer." This way, he would draw the attention of brothers and sisters in faith to the importance of the time of daily ritual prayers and the status of congregational prayer, and that in the mosque. Indeed, holding congregational prayers in mosques was the practice and recommendation of the Prophet of Islam. The Prophet's dear daughter, Lady Fatima, blessings of God upon her, also used to make preparations for her children to perform midnight prayer. She would give simple food to her children to enable them to keep vigil, particularly during the great nights of Qadr. This was the practice of the progeny of the Prophet. They not only paid attention to obligatory daily prayers, but also they considered high status for recommended prayers, especially midnight prayer, which plays a very great role in purifying the self, gaining material goals, and achieving spiritual degrees. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "In the month of Ramadan, be engaged in seeking forgiveness and ample prayer. Prayer and supplication will repel your calamities, and seeking forgiveness will destroy your sins."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Mohammed. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the row over the Muslim headscarf in the southern Indian state of Karnataka and how it constitutes blatant violation of religious freedom. And we shall also look at the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party anti-Muslim agenda and hideous attempts to fan the flames of communalism.
In the world's largest democracy, young Muslim women are fighting the biggest and most decisive battle of their lives. The ban on wearing hijab in schools in a southern Indian state has become a new flashpoint in the battle over rights of religious minorities in India, sparking global outcry. While Muslim students have stood their ground and refused to cave in, radical Hindu groups backed by the state have been resorting to extreme repressive measures to enforce the diktat.
The southern Indian state of Karnataka, governed by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has been rocked by protests in recent months over the ban on hijab in government-run schools. The controversy erupted last December at a girls' school in the city of Udupi when several hijab-clad Muslim students were denied entry into classrooms. The girls' students protested over what they believed was a violation of their right to religious freedom, guaranteed under Article 25 of the Indian Constitution. Since then, protests have spread to other cities in the southern Indian state as well as the national capital, New Delhi, as more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on the Islamic headscarf under the pressure of radical hate-mongering Hindu groups. Stung by growing protests, the government in Karnataka last week ordered closure of high schools and colleges in the state, and the matter reached the region's High Court. Muslim girl students filed a petition to question how their hijab was disturbing equality, integrity, and law and order, on the basis of which the state government had banned them from the school. The court referred the matter to a bigger bench as it involves constitutional questions of personal law.
I think that the courts are, and I think that the courts have consistently, in the past as well, upheld religious freedoms, upheld what they believe is the, like I said, a standard essential religious practice. But I think that the difficulty that I personally am seeing in this particular debate is, I think that instead of handling the question sort of head on and saying that, well, it is not the job of the individual who is seeking the ban to explain why this is an essential religious practice. It is the job of the state to explain why it is curtailing the exercise of this freedom. And so what the Karnataka High Court has now done as an interim measure is to say that nobody can exercise any of their religious practices. And so in the interim, in order to uphold public order, the court has said that, well, you know, even Hindus can't wear shawls or Muslims, and therefore Muslim women can also not wear hijab. But I think what they are conflating is that, first of all, Hindus wearing shawls, you know, wearing saffron shawls, is not necessarily, at least from my understanding, a religious practice which they really felt the need to earlier exercise. I think it was a reaction to Muslim women wearing hijabs. So I think that by comparing the two of them and making them equal, the court may have made this a harder issue for itself to solve, because I think that the question is still very simple. The question is just, there are freedoms, and there are freedoms of equality, and then there are freedoms of religion. And unless there is an overwhelming public interest to curtail either of them, the courts must necessarily favor the right to exercise those freedoms.
Protests against what is being seen as a flagrant violation of religious freedom in the Democratic Republic of India have spread far and wide, causing Narendra Modi government in New Delhi a huge embarrassment. Amidst the chaos, a Muslim student from Kolkata has become a symbol of heroic fight against right-wing hooliganism and the BJP's government's anti-Muslim policies. Muskan Khan's viral video, in which she confronts a Hindu mob with thunderous chants of Allahu Akbar, has caught the imagination of well-meaning people across India and beyond.
On the cold, wintry morning of February the 8th, a young Muslim student, Muskan Khan, parked her bike outside her school in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Wearing hijab, as she scampered across the school grounds, a group of men sporting saffron scarves, clothing associated with right-wing Hindu groups, accosted her in an intimidating way. A viral video of the incident showed the mob heckling her and demanding that she take off her face and head coverings. They hollered Jai Shri Ram, a slogan of radical Hindu groups. In response, the brave girl, far from being intimidated, looked them in the eye and chanted Allahu Akbar while punching her fist in the air as a sign of protest. The video became viral on social media, provoking strong reactions from civil society, media, and Muslim groups in the country.
I think it's extremely brave. And I think that, you know, women individually have been fighting this fight, and this is across the board, I think, especially women from minority religious communities in India. They've been fighting this fight on the individualized skin. And it started in Udupi much earlier in December itself in Karnataka, because some of these rules are completely new. There seems to be no reason why an educational institution has really come up with this. When for 30 odd years, you know, of course there are school uniforms, and that's a whole other debate, but you know, large colleges do allow people to wear what they want to wear, subject to certain broad restrictions. So I think that this video of this girl confronting the vigilante, it's definitely extremely powerful. And I think that it opened up a lot of debates, opened up older debates in India about really how hard it is for women across the country to exercise their rights, to feel enfranchised, to feel like they have a voice say in something that is happening very concretely to them. So I think definitely this is it's an important video, and it's an important memory for India to remember what women have faced, the basis to even be enforced something that is extremely basic and really universal at all.
The confrontation between the schoolgirl and the mob of Hindu zealots illustrates the deepening religious divide in India under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government and increasing vulnerability of religious minorities. The viral video has inspired an online pain in India, Muslim women reasserting their religious identity. The hashtag #HijabIsOurRight has been trending on Twitter, resonating with people across the world.
The controversy over hijab in India divided the nation among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. Politicians and activists associated with the Hindu national government at the center and states have gone out of their way to support the ban on women's headscarf. On the other hand, some opposition parties, civil society groups, and Muslim organizations have announced what they see as the blatant breach of India's constitution and fundamental rights.
The right-wing government in Karnataka last week issued a note in support of the school's ban on hijab. In a circular, it directed schools and colleges in the state to strictly enforce a uniform dress code. In response, one of the students filed a legal petition arguing that wearing the scarf was a fundamental right to religion guaranteed by the Indian Constitution. The court will now have to decide hijab constitutes an essential religious practice and whether the ban is warranted.
It's an individual right. So practicing a religious belief or practicing on their heads, it's a visual right. Rights has to be prevailed. That's rights has been given to the students.
The opponents of the ban contend the issue, which pertains to freedom of conscience and free profession, practice and propagation of religion, enshrined in Article 25 of the Constitution. However, the government officials in Karnataka think otherwise.
In my college, when I joined it, they just told me that if you're wearing a hijab, you can wear a hijab. Make sure it matches your uniform. We did that. Why, if right now they have this question, why did they allow us to wear it? If they did not had a problem from this, why did they allow us at one time? That's, you know, and moreover, it is not promoting our religion. This is our way to our pride, our modesty. It's just a way of us showing us that is our, you know, this is written in our religion. That's supposed to cover us. This is our pride. We wear it as telling it's a pride that, okay, you know, we are wearing hijab, you too start wearing it. We are not promoting and provoking everyone to wear. We are just wearing it because it's written in our religion.
Many political commentators see the hijab row as part of a sinister maneuver by the BJP government in New Delhi. Communal tensions at times when elections are underway to choose a new government in the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh. The northern instance is nearly 2,000 kilometers away from Karnataka. The hijab controversy is closely tied to the party's national electoral strategy. BJP long banked Islamophobic populism to win state elections.
The fault lines between the majority Hindu and minority Muslim community in the world's second most populous country have terrifyingly widened since the Hindu nationalist government came to power in 2014. The toxicity of hate and hostility towards Muslims, who make up around 14% of the country's 1.4 billion population, threatens to tear apart the fabric of India's secular democracy. Latest row over observance of hijab, the Muslim headscarf, has to be seen in the context of state elections in Uttar Pradesh, the most populated and the most crucial state in the country, as well as next year's election in Karnataka. The frequent communal flare-ups in India in recent years have largely happened around election time and due to incitement from radical Hindu groups. Appealing to emotions of Hindu pride and invoking the imaginary fear of Islamic expansionism has won the right-wing BJP many state elections since 2014.
Over the last, about 7-8 years, we are increasingly seeing that conversations about religion, conversations about conservative political thoughts, etc., are taking the forefront more. I think 8-10 years back when we were growing up, I don't remember having this level of conversation continuously about religion, and I felt that there was definitely the idea of secularism was a very clear idea growing up, and it was very clear to us that the Indian constitution protected all religious freedoms. And I think now you're definitely seeing a shift in that. And I think that that's sort of across the board. That's across the board with whether there are elections happening, elections not happening. And I definitely think that that is something that we are seeing a lot. And I think it would be incorrect to say that this is happening to all religions, because it is not. And in fact, we were just looking up something that, you know, there is, Sikhs are allowed to practice their religion.
Karnataka in South India and Uttar Pradesh in North India are tied by a convoluted umbilical cord, as both states are ruled by BJP. Karnataka has emerged as the new Hindutva laboratory in South India, while Uttar Pradesh has in recent years seen a rising number of anti-Muslim hate crimes. Experts say what happens in Karnataka is directly proportional to what happens in Uttar Pradesh and vice versa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Simi Pasha, an independent journalist from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, Simi. So as you know, the iron-fisted ban on hijab in schools in the southern Indian state of Karnataka has sparked global outcry. Do you think the ban makes mockery of the country's constitution?
Thank you so much for discussing this issue and speaking to me about it. As an Indian, it's actually deeply disturbing to witness the kind of scenes that we're seeing all over the country. It's not just down south now. There are several instances that have been reported in Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh as well, North Indian states and in central India. While the courts decide whether a ban on hijab is actually a violation of fundamental rights, in my opinion, it definitely is. It's contrary to the idea of freedom, constitutional right of freedom and equality. These are fundamental rights that the Constitution of India guarantees every citizen of the country. I beg your pardon. It's also a violation of cultural and educational rights. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution protects the rights of minorities, especially if these minority groups have their own separate culture or language or script. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution gives the minority group a right to preserve their culture and protects them by preventing the state from imposing an outside culture on them. So I think these articles, what we're seeing in Karnataka is a violation of fundamental rights. In my opinion, what the courts will be examining is whether the wearing of hijab is an essential practice under Islam, because there are two other articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 25 and 26, that allow freedom to practice any religion. So, for example, you have Sikhs in our country, people who practice Sikhism. They wear turbans on their head and they carry a kirpan, which is a small knife which they carry on them. This is allowed by the Constitution. Similarly, the courts will be examining whether wearing a hijab is an essential religious practice.
So, Simi, it started with one school, and now more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on hijab in Karnataka. Why is this piece of clothing making authorities so agitated?
So this ban on hijab has actually just come out of nowhere. We've been a secular democracy for more than 70 years. Muslim women in India have been wearing burqas and hijabs for as long as we remember. There's really no real reason. There's no reason what, nobody knows what prompted that school in Udupi, the Kundapur PU college, to issue a circular saying that girls wearing hijab should not be allowed inside their schools. And, you know, on the 5th of February, which is 5 days before Uttar Pradesh went to polls, the state government issued an order saying that girls will not be allowed to wear hijabs because it's not part of their uniform. Now, interestingly, when the Karnataka state government issued this directive, it was imposing an already previous order that it had passed in 2013, which means almost from between 2013, when the rules were first passed, to 2022 now, almost 9 years that rule has not been implemented. 9 years later, and 5 years before Uttar Pradesh goes to polls, Karnataka decides to impose a ban on hijab, which according to it, it had passed in 2013. So the timing is really suspect, and it really makes one wonder what the motive behind this is. Interesting, there's one little point I'd like to make. There's a video that surfaced of Bajrang Dal and Vishwa Hindu Parishad, right-wing groups, distributing saffron shawls to Hindu boys and asking them to protest against Muslim women wearing hijab. So there's that angle as well.
Some Muslim girl students have filed a petition challenging the unfair and unjust violations of their rights to religious freedom. Are courts independent enough to deliver justice?
Well, we do have the utmost faith in our judicial system, and as an Indian Muslim and as a member of an Indian society, Indian democracy, one of the world's largest democracy, I do believe that our courts will ensure that our fundamental rights are not trampled upon.
A viral video of a young Muslim student confronting a mob of Hindu vigilantes has created an international stir. How would you describe her act of resistance?
So we saw a video of this 19-year-old girl, Muskan, who shouted Allahu Akbar when she was being heckled, chased, harassed, humiliated by a group of 40 to 50 boys with saffron scarves around their necks, chanting Jai Shri Ram. If you see that video, it's actually bone-chilling, because it's not just heckling and it's not just harassment on religious ground. There's also, you know, there's a threat of sexual violence as well. For that lonely girl to walk down that road from her scooter that she had parked, and she was walking inside school, it must have been a harrowing time. And for her to stand up and say, Allahu Akbar, it's not just an act of resistance. I think it's an act of brevity. It's an act of courage. And in fact, in an interview to an Indian news organization, she said that, for me, I said Allahu Akbar because it made me feel safe and it gave me courage. And as all Muslims, we call out to Allah when we feel unsafe or weak or under threat. And she said, that's exactly what I did.
So the hijab row has virtually divided the country among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. What's the position of opposition parties in India on this issue?
So opposition parties usually don't speak out against persecution of Muslims because they are wary of losing Hindu votes. But in this instance, they've been surprisingly vocal. Rahul Gandhi, who leads the Congress Party, which is the principal opposition party in the country, has put out several tweets supporting the girls who are wearing their hijab, fighting for their rights. His sister Priyanka Gandhi, who's also one of the vice presidents of the party, has also put out a tweet on Twitter saying that you cannot trample upon the rights of girls to wear whatever clothing they want to wear, whatever article of clothing that they choose to wear. There are other opposition parties as well who are also speaking out. But I think it's basically the Congress which has taken up the issue. The Trinamool Congress has also made some noise about it. But for once, it has come as a surprise to everyone that opposition parties are actually standing up and speaking out against persecution of Muslim girls. Because in this instance, it's also the right-wing Hindutva groups are trying to deprive Muslim girls of their basic right to receive an education, which is extremely worrying, because everybody knows if you educate a girl, you educate a future family, and to deprive Muslim girls an education is basically an attempt to push Muslims into an abyss of poverty, unemployment, and economic backwardness.
There you have it. Simi, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai slams the refusal to let hijab-clad girls inside schools in India as horrifying, urging the Indian government to end the marginalization of Muslim women. Asaduddin Owaisi, a senior Indian politician and lawmaker, hails the Muslim girl who bravely confronted a Hindu mob for her commitment to education and exercising her freedom of religion and choice. A Delhi University professor, Apurva Nand, says he is ashamed and outraged by the scenes in Karnataka where Muslim women are being forced to take off hijab, calls it against all norms of civility. Irene Akbar, a journalist and social media activist, notes that Islamophobes can't digest the idea of a religious and empowered Muslim woman, which is why they oppose hijab-clad girls seeking education. Former Jammu and Kashmir Chief Minister Omar Abdullah argues that individuals must be free to choose what to wear, adding that if BJP leaders can wear saffron robes, Muslim girls can also use hijab.
And that was our episode about the unchecked assault on religious freedom of Muslims in BJP-ruled India. We shall meet again next week.
In the limelight.
Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials blame the pandemic or inflation or Trumpism or stress or structural problems like inequality. But people do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Members of Congress Should Not Be Trading Stocks, Ever. and it has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials, blame the pandemic, or inflation, or Trumpism, or stress, or structural problems like inequality. But the American public do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. Addressing this problem calls for long-term vision and commitment, things politicians aren't always known for. But a straightforward idea gaining traction on Capitol Hill could reassure a frustrated and exhausted American public that lawmakers at least recognize this trust deficit. A ban on stock trading by members of Congress and their spouses. This idea got a fresh jolt in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic after some lawmakers first faced awkward questions about whether they used non-public information to make lucrative stock trades, just as the severity of the threat posed by the coronavirus was becoming clear. A report in December by Insider was more definitive. It revealed that in 2020 and 2021, dozens of lawmakers failed to abide by rules requiring them to promptly disclose stock trades above a certain threshold. The investigation also found that Congress does a poor job of enforcing accountability and transparency measures. In response to the uproar, there has been a push by both political parties in both houses of Congress to establish stronger guardrails on congressional stock ownership. Multiple lawmakers have introduced bills pushing variations of a ban on trading individual stocks, some tougher and more expansive than others. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly told donors in January that if, as expected, Republicans win back the House in the midterm elections this fall, they would work to pass legislation that would limit lawmakers' ability to trade stocks. In a high-stakes election year, with lawmakers eager to show voters that they feel their rage, now is the moment to drive home this popular common-sense reform. The American public has lost faith in Congress. Restoring trust in this institution requires concrete bipartisan change. A decade since Congress last made a significant effort at policing itself in this area. The Stock Act of 2012, among other measures, made it illegal for lawmakers to trade based on access to non-public information. The reforms were well-intentioned but inadequate. In practice, there are too many legal shades of grey. A clearer, brighter line needs to be drawn. For all of the Democratic Party's talk about restoring public faith in government, its leaders in the House of Representatives have been, until recently, resistant to talk of a trading ban for members. "We are a free market economy," House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in December. She added, "They should be able to participate in that." The Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, has been similarly weak, suggesting that a ban is unnecessary. While Mr. Hoyer owns no stock, he has said that members ought not to be in a different situation that they would otherwise be if they weren't members of Congress. This rationale does not pass the sniff test. Members of Congress have access to a steady stream of information that regular Americans do not. They already exist in a different, more privileged situation. The common argument that a trading ban would pose a hardship for lawmakers is no more compelling. Most of the proposals under consideration do not call for members of Congress to sell all their stock holdings. They would merely prohibit lawmakers from trading stocks in individual companies. Assets could still be held in vehicles, such as index funds or blind trusts. It also bears noting that only a sliver of American families, about 15%, directly hold stock in individual companies, as opposed to indirectly through mutual funds and the like. A stock trading ban would put lawmakers more in sync with the 85% of the American public who own no individual stock, rather than align them with the interests of the 15% of the American public who do. A ban on congressional trading enjoys a bipartisan appeal that is rare in this polarized age. A January opinion poll found that 63% of the American voters are at least somewhat in favor of such a move, with strong backing among Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike. With the support for reform growing, Nancy Pelosi adjusted course this month, saying she was open to a ban and announcing that the House Administration Committee would look into the situation. The committee chairwoman, Zoe Lofgren of California, has said her team is analyzing the existing bills and would put together a broad-based consensus proposal.